We made this.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for this episode, which is actually kind of a special installment of the podcast this week. So let me introduce a familiar voice, Tony Black. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Carl. Nice to be back on the show.
Yeah, well, okay, let's level with people. Okay, so what we're here to bring you today is a discussion about Reflections in a Golden Eye, John Huston's 1967 film with Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor. But it's not going to be me hosting this discussion. It's going to be you. You'll be speaking to Winter Tyson about this film. And we could pretend that this was always intended to be a Movie Palace episode. I was just letting you come in for a week and all that. But that's not really the case. I mean, in short, this was going to be an episode of a podcast called The New Wave, wasn't it? So
yeah.
I just wanted to sort of tee this up for people, really. Can you briefly explain like what the idea behind The New Wave was and then why we're now sat here and we're going to do it as a Movie Palace episode?
Yeah, this is... if anyone knows me and knows what I do, I'm a master of aborted projects. Right? And so a few weeks or a couple of months ago, we did an episode about Bonnie and Clyde, didn't we?
Yeah.
And that was sort of going to be the premiere of The New Wave, which was dedicated to that new Hollywood period between 67 and around the early 80s, which is a fantastic period for cinema. And to be honest, Carl, it is a podcast I kind of, in a way, would still love to do in some fashion one day.
Yeah.
But I recorded a few episodes of it, but right now it's just not quite the right time, and not necessarily because of everything else going on in the world. It's just not the right time for me to put the right amount of energy into this because, you know, you know on the Movie Palace, you do a lot of research, you prepare, you know, you have different guests on. It does take a lot of time to get these things to the standard that you have on the Movie Palace, for instance. And I'm like, well, yeah, I don't know if I have the time and the energy to do that. So I thought, let's not get ahead of myself, you know, call time on it before it even really goes fully live. And, you know, what better place to host a couple of different episodes, to be fair. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but a couple of different episodes that have been recorded that will end up on a good home on the Movie Palace.
Yeah, no, I'm really pleased that we're, you know, able to find a good home for them here. And I think what's nice is they still kind of fit. I mean, because the one we did on Bonnie and Clyde, we talked a lot about how that was kind of at this kind of turning point. And then, yeah, Reflections in the Golden Eye and In the Heat of the Night, I think it's a similar story, isn't it? So, I'm delighted to be able to put them out on the Movie Palace. I think it's great to be able to bring them to people. I think, listeners, if you like what you hear, you know, do feel free to spam Tony and try and get him to get this podcast off the ground because he's open to, you know, he's susceptible to pressure, I think. I can say that.
Yeah, I am. It's true. If enough people tell me they want it, I'll just be shameless and give it them. But yeah, I did enjoy recording this episode. I mean, Reflections in a Golden Eye is a very interesting film because it sort of does, as it fits the Movie Palace because it's a bit of a bridge in a way. It's one of those bridging films. It has classic stars of the classic kind of era, you know, people like Brando and Elizabeth Taylor and, you know, people like that. And then it also edges into this, you know, more stranger, if not necessarily auteur period, because I don't know if you could quite call this kind of project that. It's definitely unusual, you know, in terms of what it's, the kind of story it's telling, you know, the book it's adapted from, all of which we go into on the podcast. But I think people might find it interesting as that kind of, an example of that turning point, really, and sort of the end of the Movie Palace kind of zone, I guess.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Now, because the podcast, you never got to the stage of fully launching it, we're going to add a discussion in a minute, and people won't hear like a theme tune and all that, and, you know, all the kind of top and tail things we normally add to an episode. So just give us a sense quickly about Winter Tyson, who's your guest here. Like people won't have heard him before on Movie Palace, so who is he? How do you know him? And he seems like a really good guy, though.
He is. He's. I joke. I think I joked in the intro that's now gone that he's Guernsey's premier film critic, and I think he said something like, "I'm the only film critic on Guernsey." Yeah, he's a really good guy. He knows his stuff about movies. He runs a kind of movie sort of cinema sort of club, I guess, on in Guernsey, in the Channel Islands. But he's been on various other podcasts, such as The Projection Booth, which is a big favourite of mine and one of the best on the web, I'd say. He's a little bit active on social media and things like that. But he's a really interesting font of knowledge, great guy to talk to. And he knows, he's got just a love of cinema generally. And he's somebody I met through those kind of projects and online generally. He's a good guest. I think it was kind of the first time he was experiencing this sort of alongside me. So I think we do a half decent job of sort of hacking through this strange beast of a film.
Yeah, well, I listened to the conversation the other day. I really enjoyed it. I'm confident people will too. So yeah, without any further ado then, let's hear Tony and Winter's discussion about Reflections in a Golden Eye.
Reflections in a Golden Eye is quite a fascinating film to cover. This film, directed by John Huston, as I say, not one of the traditional sort of new wave directors in many ways, somebody from the old guard coming into this system, is directing a story from the novel by Carson McCullers, which he set in on an army base in the south of America. In the book, it's in the 40s. In the film, it's pretty much the time it's set, I guess, but it's not necessarily pinned down by a specific time in a way, this story. And it's essentially a melodramatic potboiler which features a number of different characters, particularly a captain called Weldon Pendleton, who is played by Marlon Brando, and his wife Leonora Pendleton, and how their lives converge with the Langtons, neighbours, and the character of Leonora, played by Elizabeth Taylor, is having an affair with Major Langdon, and his wife has dreams of leaving and going off on her own life. And at the same time, you have a very intense young private called Williams, played by Robert Forster in one of his early roles, who becomes increasingly obsessed with Leonora. And beyond that, there isn't a lot of plot, but there is a lot of subtext of passion, of repression, and it is quite a fascinating film to discuss in how it connects with the new wave era and the kind of cinema that was going on at the time. So, with that little bit of an introduction, before we get into some of the ideas and the themes and the characters and what this film is saying and some of the production side of it, I want to ask you, Winter, what you really made of this. Is this the first time you've seen Reflections in a Golden Eye? And whether it is or it isn't, what did you get from watching this film?
Yeah, so this was the first time that I'd watched this film. I've got to say, it's not a film that I'd really heard of before, despite it being a John Huston movie. But before you sort of suggested it, it wasn't one that I'd really come across. And it's not one that I have ever really heard mentioned, which I think is maybe a bit quite telling about it. You know, the film is sort of first and foremost, I think it's a melodrama, but it's of that very specific, if I say Tennessee Williams flavoured melodrama. So we're in the South, there's, you know, a deep kind of social sort of sexual repression going on, befitting of the era, and I think the military environment as well. Because we are, you know, we're smack bang in the middle of the 60s, 1 year before 68, the really explosive year. But we're on a military base, so in a way we're also 20 years in the past, which is gives the film an odd sort of feel, I think. Because, you know, the characters within the film are at once very traditional and also, you know, in the case of particularly, I think, of Elizabeth Taylor's character, Leonora, and of course Robert Forster's character. They're quite modern characters. I found the film to be one of those films that kind of it simmers without really bubbling, I think is a way to talk about it. I mean, I know. So first of all, I need to point out that I watched a full color version of this film, and my understanding is that it was originally released in a very desaturated kind of golden hue, because it's a golden eye, obviously. And I don't know if watching it in a sort of a full color version is perhaps part of my sort of dissatisfaction for it, and if it maybe needs that remove of the kind of the more filtered, stylized look to really strike home. But there are a couple of things. Like I say, it never really kind of bubbles over it, and part of that I think is due to the fact that whilst the topics, you know, we're dealing with kind of repressed sexuality, we're dealing with kind of intergenerational, inter-society stuff as well, that's kind of held back by what I think are some kind of, I would say, rather unfortunate caricatures within the film itself, particularly around the sort of the character of the housekeeper, Anna Clito, played by Sorry David, who I felt was a very caricatured character. He's kind of, it's an Asian character, a flamboyantly homosexual character, but in the way that a 1960s film would have a flamboyant character. And I also found the character of Pendleton, who is, you know, Major Pendleton, is played by Marlon Brando, so a very repressed homosexual character, is also, I found Brando too, I'm going to say ugly, but not in a, certainly not in a physical sense, because the guy is just, you know, it's always just stunning, to be honest, to look at. No matter what. But in a, I found the character, the portrayal to be a very ugly portrayal of a tortured person. And now part of this, I've got to admit, it was, I did a bit of reading before starting the film, and I can't help but be coloured by the fact that Montgomery Clift was supposed to play this character, and I think we'd have got a much more sympathetic, a less granite version of this character. Whereas, you know, Brando is kind of like, the character's almost carved in rock for a good portion of the film. Whereas I could really see Montgomery Clift being a character who's living life within two worlds. Whereas Brando is repressed to the point of, I kind of don't see how he functions. And there's not enough of, because of the type of military base it is, it's not a military base in kind of that's where people are actively in service. It's a, you know, it's a military base within the United States, which is more like a kind of a regimented community. And because of that, I don't think there's enough of a sort of regimental control on the character to really make him as blank as he is, if that makes sense. And I think this is a really kind of garish comparison, but if you think of like the Abel Ferrara body snatchers, that absolutely works, because it's about not being able to, not having your personality, but it's within a military setting. Whereas the military setting didn't, if it had have been a university campus, I don't think it would have been any different, if that makes sense. It just needed to be some kind of institution. I mean, the film does have, you know, it has some great moments of drama, some really strong, shocking moments. There's a couple of scenes that are very, quite violently shocking, involving whipping. And one's a prime bit of kind of melodramatic whipping of a character. And it's brilliant. And it's quite shocking. And within the kind of the southern milieu as well, it's quite interesting. I don't know, I found there was a lot of, like I say, a lot of heat, but not much actually being cooked up in this one. Now, I haven't read the book, so I don't know if this is representative of the book or not. And I don't know if maybe there are things in a book which colour a viewing of the film that would make for a more complete viewing. Although often kind of films of this era, they were playing safe. But I think what's interesting about this film is that I immediately thought, we've got the subject matter, but we've got a director who does not have a new sensibility, which is why it comes across as so stiff. But I mean, it's not a film I would dismiss. It's not a dismissible film, I don't think, because there's enough good stuff in there. I mean, I think Brando's fantastic in the role, even though I think the construction of the role is perhaps flawed in itself. I think he's really good. I really liked Brian Keith as Langdon, who has a couple of very interesting moments in there. But there's even a plot development with Langdon, but towards the end as well. But I didn't quite buy in that. I wasn't quite sure whether the character would do this thing, and a bit of me thinks, did it even happen? I don't know. It's an interesting film, but it's definitely a film. It's definitely a good example of an older filmmaker trying to use the tools he's been using to make a film in a modern world, and I'm not sure if the way that it's done actually works, because it doesn't really, it doesn't tell us anything about the world they're in, I don't think.
Well, you've covered a lot of ground there, and there's a lot of things.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's really good. It's a great summation.
It's
because
a whole mixture, isn't it? It's a whole stew of a film.
Yeah, there's a lot of things we can leap off and discuss there, actually, because there is a lot of interesting aspects to this film. I did read the book in advance of this, and I can tell anyone listening that this is, who hasn't read the book, that this is actually a very faithful adaptation of Carson McCullough's book, which is a very short book. It's basically a novella. It's like 100 pages. And it's a very strange book. And she's not a writer. She's, oddly enough, one of those writers, I think, who was extremely sort of well regarded in her day. But she's not necessarily carried on into the modern day outside of maybe literary circles. You know, she was a contemporary of, you mentioned Tennessee Williams, she was a contemporary of him and a friend of his. You know, she mixed in a lot of social circles. She grew up in the South, and she very quickly sort of escaped that world, went to New York, wrote her first book, and then she married a guy up there, and then and it was a big success in the early 40s. And she was feted by quite a lot of celebrity and a lot of the literary sort of culture of the time. But she was plagued by ill health, and she died at age 50. And so, in fact, she died 2 weeks before this film opened, believe it or not, in September of 1967. So, which is a strange... And this wasn't the... She wrote, I think it was four or five books she wrote. Four, all but one, which was adapted for cinema. Since the early 50s through to, or the late 40s through to Reflections in a Goldeneye. But it wasn't regarded as her best work. Her first book was called The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, which was the one that was the big success. Whereas Reflections in a Goldeneye, it didn't quite click with a lot of people. It was written, I think, in 1941, and it took, you know, 25 years for it to get made into a film, which I think the film struggles to capture kind of what McCullers was doing, because, you know, she, in many ways, I think the character of Alison Langdon, the wife of the major, played by Julie Harris very well in the film, is essentially some version of Carson McCullers. You know, she is struggles with health. She is in a marriage. You know, McCullers' husband ended up becoming an alcoholic, and they sort of were estranged. He then killed himself in 1953. And so there was a lot of darkness on that side of things. And then, as I say, she was misdiagnosed with rheumatic fever or pneumonia when she had rheumatic fever when she was young. And it sort of caused multiple strokes over her life that eventually killed her at a young age. So she was plagued by ill health, much like Alison is in the book. And there is a real there are questions as to whether or not there was a possible bisexual aspect to her. Her character, who she was, although it was, a lot of people don't think necessarily that was necessarily true, but there was a lot of, she grew up in a very sort of repressive, difficult age. You know, she came of success at the end of the Great Depression, at the point that America was about to enter the Second World War, and that there was a lot of uncertainty in the States, particularly amongst the army, as to what was going to happen and where they were. So you can kind of feel like the Reflections in a Goldeneye as a story is actually capturing a lot of that, in, you know, American tension of that, particularly when it's written in the book. And I would say that the book, which is it's quite good, but it's quite weird. And I think the problem that Houston has in the film is that it's very difficult to communicate a lot of what is better in the book in terms of getting into the head, particularly of Weldon and Williams, because those the film and the film and actually the character of Allison, you really get a sense for is quite prominent in the book in many ways. I would say that the one character who is probably portrayed pretty accurately in terms of getting across what she's about is Leonora, because she's the most simple character in many ways. You know, she's even described in the book as being a bit simple. You know, in the film, she can't write letters properly herself. You know, she needs people to help her. So she's characterized fairly well, but the rest of them, that internalization that you really get a sense of in McCullough's writing doesn't really come out in the script. In the book, Williams is a full-on psycho. Like, I mean, he is like some sort of weird mix of some kind of repressed, you know, incel and Travis Bickle, you know, all wrapped into one. He's properly kind of in his own head. He's enormously weird. And the things that you see him do in the film, like, you know, creeping into the house, sniffing Leonora's knickers, you know, obsessing over her, you know, the point where he sees her naked walking up the stairs. In the book, the whole point is that Williams grew up in a completely masculine environment as a child. And that essentially she was the first woman he saw since he was a boy and the first naked woman he ever saw. And it triggers in him the exact opposite of what is triggered in Weldon later on when he sees Williams naked. You know, it's like the flip side of both. And in the book, Weldon is far angrier than Brando can kind of get across. You know, I agree with you in that Brando looks great, but ultimately he is particularly, I think, miscast. And to some extent, Elizabeth Taylor is miscast. And a few people have said this as well, in that Brando he can't quite get across, as brilliant an actor as we know he is, he can't quite get across that internalization in a way that's needed. But then I think that's part of the problem with trying to portray this story. And, you know, nor can Robert Forster, but in fairness to Robert Forster, he doesn't have a lot to work with. He barely says anything. And that's the case in the book as well. But he can't really communicate a very internalized thing. The McCulloughs can get into the head of these people far better. And I think that's part of the problem with the film, in that it struggles to communicate this internalization in an external way. And what it makes for is, like you said, it simmers without ever the pot ever blowing off, this film. And by the time you get to the final scene, which is fairly inevitable, really, in many ways, you kind of, even if you don't guess what's going to happen, it makes sense as a kind of, you know, concluding aspect. But it doesn't really hit home in the way it maybe should. And throughout the film, there is, even though, it, as I say, it's very faithful, very, very faithful to the story, it's not as strange. Even though it is a strange film, the book is far, far weirder and far more repressive and odd and gets under your skin a bit more in terms of the psychology of it. So I think I would encourage people, if they see something in this film, maybe check the book out, because the book will give you an added complexion to what you're seeing on screen.
I mean, the thing is with the Brando character, particularly Brando's performance, is I just didn't buy the idea that he would maintain any normalcy, because the character is pitched as so odd in the first place. Because, I mean, the first thing, of course, I mean, and particularly early on in the film, he has got this southern accent that is almost, the first scene he's in, it's an almost kind of Truman Capote type voice he puts on.
Mm.
And it doesn't appear to be coming from him. And, I mean, I found it hard to kind of get into to kind of approach the character at first because of that. But then that voice seems to mellow out a bit, because Brando has got an odd voice anyway.
Yeah.
But I just found there is no way this guy maintains a normalcy with other people. He's so... I mean, how other people around him don't just assume he's got people buried. because it's just such an odd... It's such an odd performance, I think. And it's so, and in some ways, it's such a... It's a blank performance. And then you have... You have the interesting stuff about him, like the trophies he keeps. So he's stolen the spoon off one character, off Winecheck, I think it was, he stole the spoon from. And then he's got the Babe Ruth wrapper that Williams has dropped. And he keeps these trophies in this box, and the box has got pictures of Greek statues in as well. And at once, it's this really weird mixture where it's at once just intensely weird and intensely obvious in what they're trying to do. They found this very weird, they're walking this very odd line that doesn't quite hold together. Because this guy, he's kind of a basket case when he wants to be. Is sort of my main trouble with it. And as well, I think weirdly it works better for the Williams character. In fact, certainly from what I've seen of the character in the film, he is very much a cipher, which works well because he's a character who, as well as kind of being a observer himself in a very De Palma type, kink sort of way.
Yeah.
He is a character who's largely observed from afar, through windows, through trees. He's followed, but he's a character we observe along with other people. And it kind of, it works that he is somewhat of a cipher, somewhat blank, I think. But like you say, that doesn't necessarily give Robert Foster much to work with. And so when we are spending time with him as the, you know, as the focus of the scene, you can't really get a grip on what he's up to, because is he some kind of repressed pervert character? Is he actually kind of like, is a difference that he's not a repressed character, he's a sexually dangerous character in a more traditional kind of aggressive sense? Because you start to think, is he kind of some kind of Ripley-type character? Because there are a couple of moments where it looks like... I don't know if this is just coloured by things like, Ripley and Sir Tom Ripley, I mean by this. But you start to think, is he going to start to inveigle his way into these lives? But he doesn't... He kind of doesn't... He both does and he doesn't. It's a very... At the end of the day, you kind of wish you either had more of him or less of him, I think.
Like you said, he's an observer. He's like an external kind of force that's looking in on this, on this tableau. And I think, and that's the problem. They struggle to really characterise that and communicate the psychology, as I say, of Williams in the film. And he is more, like you say, as a cipher in terms of representing both the sexual awakening for his character, but also the dual sexual awakening of Weldon. The interesting thing with Brando is, I mean, he wasn't the first choice. It's, as you said, Montgomery Clift was they wanted, John Huston wanted, but and so did Elizabeth Taylor, because they were close. But then he died about a year before, of complications from alcoholism, I think. He was only like 45. And he was gay, and he was one of the... Or he was certainly had gay relationships. And, if you read into Brando's history, there are a lot of suggestions. And he sort of came out and said that, he'd had, more in the 70s, I think he'd come out and said, he'd had homosexual relationships himself. And, one of them, apparently Clift was a lover of his back in the day. So there was, apparently so. So... But Brando wasn't the first choice. Huston went to Lee Marvin, he went to Rod Steiger, he went to Richard Burton, and obviously Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor had just done Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, particularly, like, the year before, and obviously, going back, they were the big couple of their day at that point, the big celebrity couple of their day, and their stormy, tempestuous relationship. And, I think he was, and at times, you know, when he started, at the beginning when they were filming, you know, he was courted by John Huston. John Huston flew him to Ireland, which is where he was living, and you know, and said, I want you to play this role, and he finally agreed. And at first, he was very mumbling in his performance. He would do two or three different takes, and he would give a completely different performance, which threw people off. And then Elizabeth Taylor basically got him in, and much like Leonora sort of whips Weldon, she did that to Brando, apparently, and said, look, we all wanted Montgomery Clift. You're not him. You're not as good as him in this role. But so just sort yourself out. And apparently he did. He responded weirdly to that kind of whipping from her. And he then gave more of a straight down the line performance. And apparently he was on one of his best behaviours. You know, he's famous and notorious, Marlon Brando, for being difficult to work with in lots of different films. But in this, apparently he was a straight arrow, and he gave a very straight arrow performance. And maybe that's one of the reasons there are dual schools of thought. Some people think this is one of his best performances. Other people think it's one of his worst. I think it's sort of in the middle. I think he's fundamentally not the right person for this role, ultimately. And he's coming off the back of... He's already considered one of the great actors of his age. But he's starting to edge a little bit into the point where his career goes into a slump before The Godfather gives it a bit of a jolt, you know. And he's almost a little bit past his prime by this point. And I think there's, you know, in a way, and I think that there's some interesting psychology behind why Brando wanted to take this role. And a lot of people feel like he was using it to explore his own conflicted ideas of sexuality at the same time. So it depends what your interpretation of that is in how he conveys those feelings, that repression, and whether or not it really does leap off the screen. And I'm not sure that it does. I feel like it would have been much more interesting to see. I feel that it were much more interesting to see a Lee Marvin kind of play this role, actually. Someone with that level of sort of stern, taciturn intensity, trying to grapple with these powerful feelings that he doesn't have a clue what to do with, about this, not just this young guy who he physically is attracted to, but there's a key point in the book, which is also conveyed in the film towards the end, where Weldon talks about how he likes the idea of being a private again. He loves the idea of sort of going back to that much simpler state of being, in that they don't have to worry about niceties, and they don't have to worry about functions and dinners and entertaining and all that kind of thing. They just lie with their bunk mates. They get up in the morning, they clean their rifle. I think he says something like there's a cleanness to it all. There's a ruggedness, but there's a cleanness to it. So in a way, I think there's a nostalgia with this. I think he's awakening, he's partly sexual, but it's also partly a desire to escape the box he's in and escape this world that he's in with Leonora, this loveless marriage. She's having sex with another man. She's, you know, he describes her in the film as a slattern, you know, and she is in the book very much a tart, really. There isn't much in terms of dimension to her. And one of the criticisms of the film was that Elizabeth Taylor was miscast because she was too glamorous and she was too well known to sort of pull off this kind of rough and ready tart kind of role. You know, after coming off the back of Cleopatra and being one of the great sort of screen beauties of her age. And I don't necessarily subscribe to the fact that she's not good in this role, though. I think she is. I think she actually plays this role quite well. And I think she comes across... She is a bit miscast, but I think she wrestles with it quite well. I think she manages to get across the shade of that character, really. But it's whether or not, you know, you really necessarily... I just feel like the combination of those two should be far more explosive than it actually ends up being.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and especially because, I mean, at the start of the film, I mean, you can't help but be coloured by having seen, you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and, you know, some of things like, can't hit Hot Tin Roof, etc. And it doesn't give you, though, the same pleasures that those films give you. It's not doing the same thing. But having Elizabeth Taylor there kind of sets you up within the film itself to it sets up those ideas and associations. So even though I don't think she's bad at all in this film. In fact, she is very good, and you get a very good sense of her character, I think. But you do have her cinematic past is inescapable in this film, I think, especially because we're sat around playing cards and we're in living rooms, and you know there is that kind of social swirl going on as well within this film. There are two moments, I think, with Brando that are just, and it's why Brando is Brando to me. There's a moment when he walks into the stables and he seems to almost completely undo and then do himself back up again within about two steps of realizing that the guy that Williams is out on a ride. Because he asks for the horse, and the guy says, "Oh, Williams already has the horse," and he realizes Williams is out there, and he does this, and it's almost as if he completely disarms and rearms himself within about 2 seconds. And then towards the end of the film, when he thinks Williams is going to be visiting him, and he straightens his hair, he's sat in his room, and he sees Williams coming. He goes back to his room, and he makes himself presentable. And those two moments are brilliant, and it's Brando just kind of dropping the pretense. But the problem with both of those moments is that I don't sense the connection between him within the film. I don't think there's the connection between him and Williams that we're supposed to feel. They don't feel, and this is part of my problem, I don't know why he'd think Williams was coming to see him. I don't know why he'd, apart from him glancing, I don't see a strong connection between the two characters in any way. And I think that's perhaps at the core of this film, is you don't get a real feel for him being undone by Williams.
Yeah, and that does happen in the book. Like, that's the difference. In the book, there is this really vivid sequence that the film does have, in which the Leonora's horse, Firebird, which he takes out to ride, even though, you know, she says, you know, you can't ride Firebird, you're not as good a rider as I am. And then Firebird sort of loses control, and he takes him on this, you know, careers him through the forest. And then he sees Williams naked. Because one thing in the book, this is the strangest of the book, Williams will just, he doesn't really communicate with his bunk mates. He goes off for long periods of time. He never really talks. He goes and wanders in the forests around the army base. And I think it's Justine Smith for Senses of Cinema writes about how this forest almost could be the end of the world, that the whole world sort of in this film and in the book sort of encapsulates around in this army base. You never really get a sense of anything beyond it, and the forest is like the boundary, and it's a place that Williams goes out and he stares up into the stars, and he just sort of lets the universe come into him. And it's really, in the book, it's all really intense. You know, you really get the sense of this strange guy, and he just takes his clothes off and he just lies on a rock. And you see that in the film. And in the book, there's this sequence where Weldon goes out there and he sees that, and the horse carries him along, and he loses his mind. You know, he really does have this powerful awakening he can't understand. And then, you know, he whips the horse, and he gets his anger and his frustration out on the horse by whipping this horse, which is something that, you know, is an inversion of the kind of thing that Leonora does to him. But it's in there. It's in the book. It just it doesn't come out on film. And I think a lot of it goes back to the fact I was surprised at how faithful the story was in a way to the book, because the book, I don't think the book would be easy to sort of translate, because it is so internal. And that's the whole problem with a story like this, when there isn't actually a lot of stuff going on. You know, there's a lot of the book is in people's heads. A lot of the, you know, there's loads of stuff between Alison and Anacleto in the book that you get a fair bit of in the film, but it's not nearly to the same extent, I don't think, as in the book, really. So there are elements of it that inevitably the story is trying to focus as much as possible on Brando and Taylor, which makes sense. You know, they're your stars. But they had no idea how to sell this film. You know, that was one of the reasons that it didn't do brilliantly well. And maybe one of the reasons it hasn't really carried on through the ages, you know, with a lot of people. Because they tried to market it, I think, as like this very sexual kind of, you know, if not thriller, then just melodramatic sort of rough and ready, sexy kind of film. But it's not. It's not really like that. You know, it's not. It's weirdly, and well, actually, I was going to say it's sort of almost weirdly asexual, but that's not weird if you read the book. The book is all about how these people don't let this stuff out, really. You know, you're never going to get that scene where there's a hot romping sex scene in this film, because it's not in the book. It's all about how people can't cope with all this, you know. And I think it's filled with fascinating ideas, but it doesn't really. It's more about the mood of it, which is why it's termed as part of what is called the Southern Gothic genre of, which is fascinating to read about. And a lot of it is, you know, when you go back to Tennessee Williams and those kind of stories, but it is all about stuff set in this part of the world. In fact, Williams talked about how Reflections in a Golden Eye, when it was criticised for what was called excessive grotesquerie in 1941, he said there is, talking about the Gothic school that he and Carson McCullers were sort of subscribed to, he said there's something in the region, something in the blood and culture of the southern state that has somehow made them the centre of this Gothic school of writers. He said it's a sense. He said it's similar to sort of French existentialism. He says it's a sense, an intuition of an underlying dreadfulness in modern experience. And I think that's interesting, in that there is a feel of dread in this film, like an ominous sense that these people are trapped in this strange, intense netherworld that they can never really escape. So in terms of mood, I think at times Houston is quite successful in conveying that, but I don't think he can truly convey the passion and the repression in the way that this film wanted to.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, there's a, there are a couple of moments where it does really fly, and you've already mentioned the scene where the horse runs away with him, with Brando on, and that's an incredible. I mean, that's a real kind of neck-breakingly sort of physical scene. You really get a sense of a kind of it's almost like a punishment going on there. And also, there's a scene where, and it's the closest you get to a connection between Pendleton and Williams, is the scene where Pendleton follows Williams after the boxing match. And you never quite know if Williams is aware of even who's there. I mean, you get a sense that he knows he's being followed, but you never quite sense whether he knows who's following him, I think. And it's essentially a pickup scene that isn't consummated in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of the consummation, I suppose, is the, you know, he picks up the trophy, the Babe Ruth wrapper, which goes into his box. And these are two moments. And you've already mentioned when Leonora whips him in the middle of a kind of a social gathering. And that's great. And you just kind of like, where's the rest of the film around this stuff? Because I don't kind of. There are really good. Like I say it's a film of good moments and a couple of very startling ones, but it never, for me, it doesn't quite get there because there's no connections between the characters. And as well, I mean, if we can talk about Anna Clayto for a bit, and also Wynczek, the portrayal of these two characters is really odd. I mean, Wynczek might as well not be in the film. And you know, he's a character, and there's a hint that, you know, he's not the right sort for the military, and you get a sense that he may also be homosexual. But the Alec Clayto character is just I found it just howlingly of its time. Especially because at the same time you've got Lieutenant Langdon sat in the room looking in utter disgust at the very existence of Anna Clayto as well, and it's a really weird film in that it does this thing where it's at once trying to kind of make you invest in what it must be like to be repressed. But in the scenes, particularly in the scenes where Langdon and Anna Clayto are together in a scene, it also, you kind of get the impression that the film really disapproves of Anna Clayto. It also really disapproves of people who are gay. And it is one of those, what does the film want from us? Is Brando's closeted suffering, is that to be sympathised with, or is the fact that he can't keep a lid on himself to be somehow, we're supposed to feel sorry? Are we feeling sorry for the person being closeted, or the person who is not able to closet themselves fully?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? I think there's a difference there.
Yeah, I agree. I want to read something from Nick Pinkerton that he wrote about the Southern Gothic tradition that might not seem connected to this, but I will get to a point with this. He said that the American, talking about the Southern Gothic and the American South, that he said the American South has certainly enjoyed its share of romanticisation and idealisation. You can find Northern men of letters such as Henry Miller in 1945's The Air Conditioned Nightmare and Edmund Wilson in 1962's Patriotic Gore playing with the myth of the noble Southern, inverted commas, lost cause as a repudiation of the industrialisation that followed the Union victory. So going back to the Civil War, because a lot of the Gothic tradition goes back to, the Southern Gothic tradition goes back to the divide after the Civil War in the mid-19th century. And a lot of that, how essentially, and it still exists today in many ways, that there is a big difference between the North and the South of the United States and how the people, think about the world. I mean, if you look at it in the modern age, you would probably find that there would be a lot more Republicans on the South and Democrats in the North. That's being fairly generalising, but I think there is a distinction between the two. That's partly what it is. Anyway, he says more generally, however, it has in popular culture performed the admirable function of acting as a scapegoat for the North, a means to reassure the Yankee of his own civilization by allowing him to hold himself above his Southern cousins, foregoing addressing the prejudices of his own country by externalising and projecting them onto a convenient other. The United States serves this function for a great many other nations, while itself preferring to use Russia for these purposes. Now, the reason I bring this up is that I think part of the Gothic tradition in this film, and potentially in the book, is that Anna Clayto and potentially Wycheck represent an other. That homosexuality itself represents an other in this film, in that these traditional masculine male army characters within this very traditional military structure in the United States. And bear in mind, the book is written just before they enter the war, so during the wartime period. And the film exists on that very, very, on that borderland between counterculture in the 60s and historical prejudice. And it sort of exists in the two. So if you think about it in those terms, it is absolutely of its time. You're absolutely right about Anna Clayto. Is the Southern mindset in this case perpetuating that intense homophobia and that's why Anna Clayto is very clearly gay, even though it's specifically said on screen. He has this relationship with Alison that is like her gay best friend, basically. And he's very out and flamboyant and he's dancing around. And Langdon even says at one point, oh, if only I could get him in the army, And that he'd be unhappier, but he'd be better, That sums it up completely. That line essentially sums it up. Anna Clayto is the most happy, free character in this entire film, and that's something that I think in this story. And whether or not it's a level of conservatism in the way that Houston films it or the way that the story is, in that there is a fear, I think, of that external other, particularly within this part of the world and where this story is set and kind of the themes and the ideas that this film is communicating. My question to you on that sense would be, does that make this a strange film for this kind of new wave movement? Because is this another yet indicative fact that it's being filmed by somebody who isn't a new wave director, isn't in the vein of, you know, John Huston is 62 by the time he films this film. He's grown up in a very, very different world, you know. And I think it's very interesting to think of Reflections in a GoldenEye as having one foot in portraying some of these ideas and suggesting some of these things that you wouldn't have seen in the studio era, but at the same time also being a bit terrified of what they suggest.
One of the problems here is that I think there's a lack of humanity given to the characters in the film. And perhaps a, kind of one of the reasons that Brian Keith is so good as Langdon is because he seems to be the character in which there is some humanity given to, because he is at once kind of, you know, he's an interesting foil to Pemberton. He's put upon, but he's an adulterous husband, but you do see his suffering, like the suffering he goes through due to his wife's illness. So you can see where, hang on, you know, with that character there is a, but you know, everything's not quite as it seems, because she does seem to have this closer relationship with Anna Clayto that's outside of his relationship with her. So in a way, he's been othered by their relationship. And it's not my sort of view of the character. I think this is what the film does, whether inadvertently or not. I think that Langdon's character has the most kind of humanity, because ultimately I think the Brando character's too kind of grotesque and too granite to actually invest in. I think his wife, Leonora, is also too flighty, because one of the things with Leonora in this film is she doesn't actually have any kind of arc. She is variously annoyed at her husband and a bit more so later. So there is, you know, she doesn't seem to, that character doesn't really, to my mind, really progress. And then you have, you know, there's just not enough of Wynczek to really know what was going on. And in a way, Wynczek's a bit like Williams. Wynczek would have been more interesting to either have been, had more presence, more of their own presence in the film, or to have just been spoken about and observed. Because he's obviously there as a kind of a in Pemberton's mind, a cautionary tale of, if you're not being who you should be, you know, your Wynczek, who's also played as a kind of, he looks more like a university professor than someone on an army base when we do actually meet the guy. But I just think what you've got here is you've got the subject matter. You've got the actors who are, you know, individually doing their own thing and very good at it. But I mean, I don't think the film allows the performances to be as good or as interesting or as deep they could be. And I at the end of the day, I don't think there's enough personal investment from Huston to allow the characters to be as human as they should be in this story. And you made a point before about it would have been interesting to have seen Lee Marvin in this role. And I think with someone, either, Montgomery Clift is still alive and does this film, in which case Montgomery Clift's sort of screen presence in itself is a, you know, a presence that is, that has his acting has such an entrenched humanity to it. His screen presence is not, you know, is not one of intense masculinity. Or you go with Lee Marvin, who would be, oh my god, that he would be an absolute stand-in for Huston in a way.
Yeah,
because he's of that, whereas Brando isn't. Brando is of the city, whereas Huston is not.
Yeah,
do you see what I mean? Brando is urban in a way that Huston isn't. And I think Lee Marvin would have shared more of a, he'd have shared more commonality with Houston himself.
Yeah, I just don't ever really believe that Brando is an army guy, like, in a way. Like, I feel like he's... Marvin, like, I think this is what you partly what you might be getting at, in that Marvin and Houston, you feel like there is that there would potentially be that level of, you know, taciturn authority to them, and I don't. And Brando is too intentionally sort of
he's a bit of a and it's an odd thing, but he's more of a school mom,
yeah,
than an army guy.
Yeah. He is. And he's also, but you know, by his very nature, he's method. You know, the fact that Brando was all method, he was all about experiential kind of performance, in that it's why, yeah, there are times he's labelled the greatest living actor, you know, at that point, or one of the greatest actors in cinema history. But there are times he's awful, because he doesn't really, he either inhabits that role completely, or he doesn't. And I think in this case, the miscast aspect is that he can't quite get across that like you're getting at, I think, that feeling of that he fundamentally cannot cope with these very liberal this open-minded aspect to sexuality, when the reality is that Brando himself could. You know, Brando was all about causes, wasn't he? He was all about, you know, at this point, he's championing the Native Americans and the Black Panthers. You know, he's just a few years away from when he sends Sachin Littlefeather on stage to, you know, refuse his Oscar for The Godfather. I think it's for The Godfather. And it's, you know, he's all about that kind of, you know, a very anti-conservative kind of causes. So I get the feeling he would be fine with homosexuality as a person. You know, in many ways. So I think even if he would never come out and admit that he was gay himself, or he was bisexual, if that was the case, I feel like he can't really get to where more of a, you know, like you say, if you'd have had John Huston playing this role 20, 30 years before, I think you would have seen that far more. And maybe that's what drew Huston to the story. You know, maybe that was what he was interested in trying to get to the heart of this, you know, this kind of, this difficulty, and particularly at this point where sexual liberation is happening, there is growing awareness of homosexuality, and it's not, you know, it's something that he can do in cinema now. It's something that he can even certainly suggest at this point. You know, 10 years ago, no chance would this film have been made in this way. I don't think you would have, if they'd have made Reflections in a Goldeneye in 1957, I think it would have been a very different film. I think it would have had to have been. But at the point it's being made, they're able to really quite overtly suggest that this guy, this captain, this this married man in this position of authority just wants to get down and dirty with this this young private. And I think it's something that you needed to feel more as an audience member, and I don't think you do. And I think that's ultimately what we've been getting at through this entire conversation, that this is it's a film and it's a story that you need to feel, and I don't think you really feel in this film in the way. I think you don't get that reaction.
And I think part of that is to do with the idea that the way the film, you know, the way it's shot, the way it's edited, even, you know, the way the performances are, the whole thing screams quality production. But it screams quality production in that quite kind of lifeless and stiff way. So this is a serious film that I'm making here. It's a serious film about a serious thing. And it's quite, there's obviously, you know, a high level of filmmaking going on here. It's something one can discuss over dinner afterwards. It's as if someone said, what we want to do is we want to make people, it's a film for people who like plays.
Yeah. It would make a good play. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I think it would make a great play. And I'm not saying that in an odd way about, I'm not trying to say something odd about plays, but it's a film made by people who are targeting people who like that other smart thing that people like, with patches on their elbows and all that type of stuff. It's pitched at a very, it's a it's a story that is supposed to, you know, it's a story about contentious things, but it's aimed very much at, it's a very middle class, comfortable version of that story.
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to what a lot of the new wave was, which was a kind of a much more, I don't want to say the word street, but you know what I mean, a much more urban, a much more kind of street level view of these stories, as opposed to we're going to stand back and we're going to be quite, everyone's taking this very seriously. Can we talk about the serious film, please? And I think that's ultimately kind of the stifling point, is I don't think the film has enough life in it to really allow you to invest.
Well, I mean, you know, you only have to look at 2 years later when you've got things like Midnight Cowboy and Easy Rider, which are just blowing a hole in, you know, in what the culture is suggesting at the very end of the 60s. And yeah, this film feels, it almost immediately feels outdated. It almost immediately feels like it's part of a system that doesn't really exist anymore. And it's trying to hold to that. And, you know, it's quite fascinating in that sense, especially given that, you know, John Huston was coming off the back of a few difficult years. You know, he'd had at the start of the decade, he'd had a bit of a tormenting sort of shoot on The Misfits, you know, which I think might have been Clark Gable's last film or one of his last films. That was a difficult shoot. He'd been struggling to film The Bible for years. I mean, which is pretty obvious. I mean, that's never going to be easy, is it? But
No.
But he was trying to film The Bible at a point when the whole idea of the classic sort of religious sword and sandal epic was sort of dying off. It was at the end of its rope, basically. At this point, it's that crossover idea, and his intention to film a novel that is powerful, that is saying some interesting things, and it's saying some interesting things at an interesting point in American history in terms of when it's filmed, but it's a difficult piece to communicate in the way it needs to be communicated. Before we finish, though, let's talk a little bit about John Huston and his position at this point in this sort of movement. Because when we talked about doing this episode, you mentioned a film that came out not so long back on Netflix called The Other Side of the Wind, which features John Huston as playing in what is billed as Orson Welles' last movie, that has been reconstituted and finally finished by Netflix and by people involved in his estate and that kind of thing. But John Huston in that film plays a director in the 70s, and a lot of it is footage that was filmed in the 70s when he's, you know, when he's getting on. And I wanted to ask you about that, and whether or not, do you think that he's, you know, his appearance in that film, which is all about this transition of cinema from, you know, filmed by someone at the time in the early 70s, Orson Welles, who had come from huge success in the studio system to a point where he was perhaps questioning his relevance. Do you think John Huston is doing that in this film, and he's trying to figure out the kind of director he is in this era, having come off the back of films like, you know, Treasure of Sierra Madre and The African Queen and all these really great films he made back in the day? Is this film part of an exploration for him trying to figure out who he is in this new world?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, in The Other Side of the Wind, he's playing a director who's made a sort of an Antonioni-type film, which, you know, I've got to be honest, Welles very badly, pastiches. And, you know, and obviously it's you know, it's not Huston's film. It's very much it is Welles' film to a certain extent. But I think this Reflections in the Golden Eye is different, because Welles seems to be reacting. I would say The Other Side of Wind is very much a reaction against what's going on in cinema at the time. I mean, interestingly, it's also, you know, there's a lot of sort of verite style footage and so on and so forth. But I think Reflections in the Golden Eye is a filmmaker quite honestly attempting to, you know, what you've always got to think about this era is the new wave. Generally, you know, when you think about the new wave, you're thinking about directors who are also new.
Yeah.
Writers who are new, who are influenced by sort of, you know, who have older cinematic influences, but they're coming along and refreshing things. Whereas someone like Houston, I mean, you're talking about, you know, he's coming off stuff like, as you said, The Misfits, The List of Adrian Messenger, Night of the Iguana, very sort of very apt in this, you know, with regards to this film, I think. But I think you're seeing a director who is honestly trying to, not so much keep up, but trying to find a place within stories that are different to what he's been able to do, both in terms of, like, literally what you're allowed to say and do on screen, but also sort of thematically what people are talking about within the, you know, what people are actually talking about, as opposed to these very sort of kind of mythic stories. You look down the list and we're what, 10 years after Moby Dick, for goodness sake. And I think Houston actually survives quite well. If you're looking through his filmography, you know, you've got The Man Who Would Be King, which, you know, your Sunday bank holiday weekend afternoon kind of romping adventure. But you've also got stuff like The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, which is in itself, you know, you're moving into this kind of revisionist Western category with that stuff. So Houston is a director who keeps going, and he's able to do Wise Blood and even Priestley's Honor because he is able to actually adapt himself.
Mm.
Whereas I think the difficulty I had, particularly with Other Side of the Wind, is that Wells doesn't seem to see much there in The New Freedom, apart from, you know, because when you look at the film within a film there, it's, I think he's kind of, he's trying to lampoon something that he doesn't seem to understand. If you think also about, you know, the roles that Houston himself was actually taking on as well. So Chinatown being the most obvious, you know, he's finding a space for himself within the new wave of Hollywood. And he's not trying to be a maverick within it. He's just trying to find a way that, you know, what does a John Huston film become? And you know what? It becomes Fat City and Wise Blood, which are incredible, which are great films. Absolutely. And Roy Bean as well. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah. And you know what? I would say that if the direction of Reflections in a Goldeneye is one of the better things about it, really. I think it's better than the script. I think it's better than some of the performances. But like you say, I think there are some good performances in this. But I think he does manage to convey a sense of this world, even if it's he struggles to get across, you know, some of the melodrama of it. You know, he even manages to, you know, to get across the whole, the core idea of what the title is about. You know, the titular Reflection in a Golden Eye. You know, which is something that it's a bit clunky in the book, and it's sort of a bit clunky in the film. Because in the book, it's Anna Clayto, and in the film, Anna Clayto's talking about, you know, a peacock with a golden eye that sort of reflects, you know, the reality of a situation. And it's one of those, it's a subtext for, you know, reflecting back what could be seen as reality or a deformed version of reality. And, you know, you see the close-up of William's eye, you know, when he sees Leonora, and there's a golden tint to it. And as you said, you know, I saw it in the colorized version as well. I didn't see it in the stripped back elements of black and white and gold hue of it, which was pulled from, and one of the reasons it hasn't sustained is that it was pulled from Prince when it wasn't doing very well, when the film was released, and they released it in color feeling like it might do better, that people more people will understand it. But in doing so, they completely sort of changed some of the ethos that Houston had in terms of what he wanted to visually represent. And I think it would have made for more of a powerful film. I'd like to see the film actually with that kind of print where it's filmed in that way, because I think he might be able to get across some of this a little bit better. Some of that brooding Southern existentialism that is in the book that doesn't really come out on screen because it's fairly blandly presented. I think they wanted it to be more like a Virginia Woolf kind of potboiler as opposed to being its own thing, because they knew what they were getting with that. And I think it's a bit of a shame in that it didn't I don't think it came out in the way that Houston might have envisaged. And I think, considering, he doesn't do a bad job overall himself.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is one of those films where the material just isn't there. And I think it's from a scripting issue. I think the basis just isn't there. And like I say, there are some terrific sequences, especially the runaway horse moment, which is just absolutely, you know, it's a really good cracking bit of filming. And it's full of good performances. It's a good looking film in many respects as well, but it just doesn't have a core to it, I don't think. And what's missing is, I think perhaps it's that translation from what you seem to be saying, it's that translation from the internal nature of the source material to the external, you know, surface level film.
Yeah, I think that's essentially what the case is with this one. Yeah. Would you recommend it?
I would recommend it in a weird way, because the striking things in it are very striking, and it's an interesting and odd film. It's properly one of those, have you seen Reflections in a Gold? Have you seen that? Because that was odd, wasn't it? And you probably all, you know, and if people had seen it, they'd probably say, yeah, that was a bit weird. That
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
You know, but an it's an oddity.
I think that's true. I think that's true. I think it is particularly of its year, of its time, of its point in this era of Hollywood. But there's not a vast amount of commentary on it. There isn't really a Blu-ray out there of any note with any kind of stuff on it. It feels like the kind of film that deserves that, really. That it would be nice to see, I don't know, a Eureka pickup or you know, Arrow Academy or something, and give this some treatment, really, because I feel like there's some interesting stuff to talk about with this.
I've got to say, my go-to usually is to... I like Pauline Kael. I don't always agree with her. But I always find her really interesting. And, you know, she doesn't seem to have that much to say about it. Like, yeah. She seemed to quite like some bits of it and not other bits. And it just kind of like, ah.
Yeah.
And usually with Pauline Kael, if she seems a bit disinterested in it, to me, that's often a mark. Like I say, whether I agree or not, that's often a marker that it's not particularly caught. But it's one of those films where I'd love to hear from someone who was really infused by it. Because I'm sure there's a... As with every film, there's a case to be made. But I'd love... Particularly in films like this that I feel just don't quite do what they set out to. I'd love to hear someone really infuse about this one.
Yeah. It would be good, wouldn't it? Not even Roger Ebert did. I think he liked it. I think he thought it was interesting. But, yeah, it didn't really, you know, blow him away necessarily. So yeah, it would be. If that person's out there, let us know. If you really love Reflections in a Gold Night, you know, let us know.
All right, that's all for today, listeners. My thanks to Tony and Winter for their discussion. We'll be back with another episode soon, but in the meantime, you can find the Movie Palace in all the usual places, at Movie Palace Pod on Twitter, also on Facebook, and also on Instagram. Also, check out at We Made This Pod on Twitter to find out about our network. And if you stay tuned in a moment, you'll hear about what's going on some of our other shows. So I hope you can join us next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Back to the decade.
They're a tour bus of people, and then The Rock takes over the tour bus, and he's driving that, and he takes that head on with the criminals, and then the car like explodes into their car, and then those cars explode into the building behind it. And then once which is very
pointedly Trump Tower, which they could not have.
Oh wow, is it really?
They could not have known back then, but I noticed holy that shit. When I was watching it this most recent time, and I was that's like, amazing. That's very funny.
Pick a disc.
And like you're probably sing along and stuff and then kind of forget it exists until immediately you meet someone called Stacy, and then immediately he's like, duh, duh, duh.
Again.
Yeah. So, and I think, yeah. Yeah, so
And like, I think it's that song that a lot of bands have that kind of opens the door a little bit. For me, it was, you know, I got the album because of that song, and then kind of I grew up around the rest of the album, I guess, and started to see that the depth and the I guess the talent that went into the other songs.
Observing the Pattern, a Fringe podcast.
They are human, of course they are. It's also a nice, like you said, it's a very nice moment.
Yeah, it's lovely. And I think with Olivia, with any kind of policeman or detective or agent who works for the FBI or anything like that, if they work in a particularly nasty sector, say for, you know, violent crimes, they have to put up these psychological barriers. Otherwise, they're just, I mean, a lot of them burn out after a couple of years anyway.
Yeah.
But I can kind of apply that to Olivia. She has a lot of walls she puts up.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.